bills that we're hearing, and then notes you can make as the bills are being heard. Okay. Atkins is listening. Atkins is from, he's still in the downstairs, isn't he? Atkins is in, okay. He's got some special young people here. We were going to take him first, even though they're from the metro area. But so maybe we can start off with okay. So then, Paul Erickson, you're not from out of.
I'll be here for the whole duration.
Okay, we're gonna stay and do it later. Okay. Okay, let's.
Atkins is here.
Oh, is he? Okay. Oh, okay. Okay, let's do it then. Welcome, Representative Atkins and Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Arrows. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll file 3180.
You have three of them, 3180, 2541, and 2061.
And I appreciate your deference in allowing yourself to be heard one after another. Which one would you like to do first, Mr. Chair?
We'll start whichever one, you know.
Well, let's start with Mighty Ducklings then.
Okay.
We've got House File 2541 is, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the original version back about 10 years ago. My predecessor, actually Representative Milbert, carried the original Mighty Ducks legislation. It proved to be incredibly successful. Not for any particular corner, but literally for the entire state of Minnesota. There were dozens and dozens of grants that were made, matched by literally millions upon millions of dollars. This is, as I like to affectionately call it, the Mighty Ducklings Bill. It's been several years since we last did it. There's a need that the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission has identified that would provide for 15 new grants and 14 renovations. All across Minnesota based on need. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to our guest today, Mr. Erickson from the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission.
Welcome, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All of you should have a handout, which is a great summary of the program that occurred between 1995 and 2000. And first of all, I'd like to dispel a myth. Every once in a while, someone would say the state is building a local ice arena. At the time of the original Mighty Ducks program, the cost of a new ice arena was between $2.5 and $3 million, and the state was providing grants for $250,000. So basically what the state was doing was providing an incentive grant that was roughly 10% of the value. But the results are self-evident. On the second page of your handout, the state invested $18 million during that five-year period, and 79 grants that were for new arenas. There were some combinations. 61 new ice arenas were built in that time and 74 existing arenas. And the one thing that the program did was really facilitate the growth of girls and women's hockey as they were getting into the sport. So this handout then goes on to show you the summary of all the communities that benefited. And as Representative Atkins has mentioned, there's cities that were not ready to build between 1995 and 2000 are now emerging from as far north as Halleck, as far south, I believe that's Northfield, and there's Big Lake Becker, and a host of others that have inquired about the program. So that, I think the program is so familiar because you as legislators administered it for a five-year period. I think most of the program is known. So with that, Mr. Chairman, open up the question.
Sure. The only thing that I'd like to add is we've been talking about how it seems to be the jobs here. We're passing the bonding bill. These dollars leverage, Mr. Erickson, on a 5-to-1,
10-to-1.
So literally for every dollar we put in, we get $10 worth of bang out in Minnesota. And I think that is probably as good or better than any other provision within the entire bonding bill as far as leveraging the dollars.
And then, let's see, you're going to take the which one, field with, baseball field with,
yes, sir.
Lynn, 2061 or?
We've got a little bit more testimony from Mr. Carlson, and then we'll move to the St. Paul Amish Report Facility Building, 3180. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business, and I may have been in front of you on different issues in the past. However, I'm a volunteer member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, something I've been on since 2003, and I'm kind of a hockey guy, and so I also volunteer and represent Minnesota Hockey, and I just want you to know that Minnesota Hockey represents and has over 65,000 households participating in hockey in Minnesota. It is the largest youth hockey organization in the country. We have over 14,000 girls participating in youth hockey in Minnesota, also in the country, and we think that is a direct result of the investment that this legislature made in the Mighty Ducks program. And I would amplify one thing. Mr. Erickson talks about relative to the cities that are and communities that are talking about using this money for expanding their facilities. During the summer, we sent an email out to all of the member associations for Minnesota Hockey, and we got back 53 responses from communities that would be ready to go with projects, whether it's new facilities or expansions, and they range from Laconia, Champlin, Northfield, Little Falls, Worthington, Edina. They're across the state, and they're ready to make that investment, and we think that this is an absolute great opportunity. And just on behalf of the commission, I want to thank this legislature and all of you for the work that you do to support the amateur athletics, and we think it's a great program for the kids, and happy to answer any questions. But these communities are ready to work. Okay.
Thank you. 3180.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3180 is a proposal for the St. Paul Amateur Sports Facility. I'll be joined again by folks from St. Paul, as well as we're working with the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission on this project as well. Soccer has exploded in the East Metro, and this is an effort to try to catch up with that explosion of the number of kids that are participating in the soccer program. It also is going to work hand-in-hand with the folks at the City of St. Paul and St. Paul Saints with respect to Midway Stadium, which I didn't know until I actually went out and kicked the tires. Midway Stadium is a hub for amateur sports. It's also, of course, home to our beloved St. Paul Saints. And with that, I think I may have the folks that want to join me here with respect to that. There should be a proposal in your packet with regard to the specs. Lo and behold, here's Mr. Erickson once again. We have some folks, both Mr. Erickson and Mr. Burscheid from the St. Paul Parks and Recreation Department. They are here to both answer your questions and may provide brief testimony for you as well.
Mr. Jones, the Amateur Sports Commission has been meeting with St. Paul for some time, and I'm going to have Bob Burscheid, the park director, come up. If you remember, in addition to Mighty Ducks, years ago we also had a Mighty Kick, and we built 140 new soccer fields across the state. The most acute need and shortage of soccer fields is in St. Paul and in Minneapolis in the city area, because the ethnic groups do not come from Somalia and Mexico and Honduras with a hockey tradition. They come with a soccer tradition. And so we thought it was, as St. Paul looked at the renovation of Midway with that baseball legacy, and they looked beyond the Midway site into other areas, we thought it was important to interface with St. Paul to analyze and to see where we could build some infrastructure for soccer, which would add some economic development activity to the tournament. So with that, Bob Burscheid from St. Paul
is... Mr. Chair, this is Burscheid. Mr. Beck is also here from St. Paul Saints.
Bills that have the shortest testimony have the best chance of pass. We recommend that.
Thank you for your time, members.
Thank you, Representative Bat.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Burscheid, and I have the privilege of serving as Director of Parks and Recreation for the City of St. Paul. I'm very pleased to be here with Paul Erickson and the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission to support the designation of St. Paul as Minnesota's Urban Recreation Sports Center. I'd also like to acknowledge Mr. Jim Rail, who is one of our amateur sports team, is here in the audience, as well as Bob Klepper, the manager of Midway Stadium. I will keep my comments brief, and the need for Midway Stadium, and at the end we'd be happy to answer any of your questions. The current Midway Stadium is 30 years old. It is a home, of course, to one of the best baseball organizations in the United States, the St. Paul Saints. It is also the home of sectional and state high school baseball tournaments, the Hamlin University baseball team, and countless youth and amateur baseball and football teams. The current stadium is actually the third Midway Stadium in St. Paul. The first was known as Lexington Park, was built in 1920 and hosted the first Saints team, and also played host to, on numerous occasions, Hall of Famer Willie Mays. The second park was built in 1957, and the current Midway Stadium was built in 1982. There's an incredible amount of Minnesota history on these ball fields. It is important to appreciate the breadth of Midway's activities in one given year. In 2007, Midway was open 212 days of the year. 176 of those days were filled with students, adults, families from one event or another. Only 50 of those days were for the Saints. The other 125 days were for amateur and youth activities. I would like to acknowledge, though, that the Saints have agreed to partner with us on the redevelopment of that stadium. That's important to us. Out of a total of 320,000 baseball game attendees in 2007, 56% of them were for Saints games. The rest were municipal, Legion, college, and regional high school games. High school and rec center football games brought in another 5,000 fans. The result of these several hundred thousand visitors is increased economic benefits to St. Paul and the entire North Metro area. I would also like to invite all of you to St. Paul this summer. We are hosting the 2010 Star of the North team with the Amateur Sports Commission. Hopefully most of you have had a chance to attend an event at Midway, and you don't need a lot of facts and figures to know that Midway is bursting at the seams. This project is about meeting the demand currently at Midway. It's not about trying to grow bigger, it's trying to be better. We need to accommodate what we have, make it better, safer, and ready to last another 30 years. Again, I'm pleased to be partnering with the Sports Commission. We think this makes sense as a joint effort, and it will be an economic stimulus for both the City of St. Paul and the State of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
You should have, by the way, this brochure, I think, in your packet about...
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll do it later. We'll do the question. House file 2061.
That's the next step.
Thank you.
From Miracle Field was joining us today. I appreciate it. Mr. Clark has done it for you. Miracle Field, this field is sort of like Mighty Ducks for Miracle Field. If you're not familiar with what Miracle Field is, Mr. Clark will give you a good rundown on it. But very briefly, my daughter was in first grade. She had a young man on her team that was in a wheelchair who had great joy in playing baseball. And his teammates loved it as well. The only problem was the field being grass and dirty. Pretty often it's hard to negotiate when you're in a wheelchair. We're not suggesting to build a synthetic surface field like these Miracle Fields are literally in every neighborhood, but there ought to be some for kids to participate. A couple have been built. There's lots and lots of private efforts to try to do this. The goal here was to try to have the state participate in a fashion that would leverage just very thin to the Mighty Ducks proposal from years ago and the one from this year that would leverage dollars on a 5 or 10 or 15 to 1 basis to have these fields built. There's several hundred thousand kids that are classified as having disabilities by the Department of Education. This just gives them an opportunity to participate in American pastime in a fashion that they'll enjoy and enjoy. And with that, folks, I'll turn it over to my friend Kevin Dorsey from the Miracle Field Committee.
Thank you. Miracle League was founded in 2000 out of Atlanta, Georgia. The first field was built in 2000 in support of the Rotary there. I brought it here, the Miracle League, in 2004 with the idea of being a center point for communities to basically put this program together. We built thus far a field in Blaine and Rochester, have fields being in process right now in Mankato, Minnetonka, Woodbury are working in St. Cloud, Duluth, have interest now all of a sudden from Brainerd, Alexandria, and Moorhead area as well. Basically, the field is built on crushed rubber. Some of you folks have seen that kind of stuff. It's built on in recreational facilities right now. It provides for a safe surface for these kids, wheelchairs, walkers, to be included in play. One of the big things we do is make sure that these fields are built in the baseball complex in these communities so they can feel like they're part of the action as far as going on. And we integrate youth baseball as far as buddies with these kids to play. And basically that's our program. And thus far, you know, just to give you an idea, in our first year in Blaine, we had over 140 kids playing. This year we'll have over 200. In Rochester, we have the same number of kids playing. So there's certainly a need. And the attraction is that it's a safe place for these kids and their families to come play. There's multi-use to the fields in many areas. When our fields are not in use, they're being used for adaptive soccer and a few other things as well. We're taking the lead as far as for programming through baseball.
Okay. Well, thank you. So one, the author and one witness, is that okay?
Works for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Good explanation and good bill.
Thank you.
Yes, is
there Mr. Chairman, two questions. One, what's the suggested number for the appropriation?
We're looking at $250,000. And then the idea behind it would be likely to have several grants of less than that, but the idea of leveraging it with private donations.
Okay, this other thing has come up, and I don't know if you've thought about this. The whole set of people who are complaining about the environmental effects of the crushed rubber and the, in fact, the deleterious effects of it on kids. There's a report out from New York that suggests that you actually, if a kid comes in from playing on a crushed rubber field, you actually treat it like they was, came out of a hazardous waste facility in terms of taking off their clothes in the garage, showering before they get, as they get into the house and changing.
Yeah, let me address that. Those fields, the biggest problem with a number of those surfaces that have been built that way were built with latex and a latex adhesive. And the big problem with a lot of those earlier on facilities that were built with that crushed rubber were built with latex in the within the materials itself. And we use non-latex products specifically for that reason, because we've got a lot of kids with allergies, etc. So we've taken those steps as far as to make sure that the material does not have any kind of latex in it.
Well, one of the things that, Mr. Chairman, one of the things you're usually talking about is crushed, so this is not using crushed rubber tires?
No, this is not.
So what kind of material is it?
Well, it's a rubber product, but it is non-latex based.
And is that the only problem with the crushed?
That's the only thing that we've ever heard before.
That
right.
Doesn't seem to be just what they're saying. You said that the substitute product is actually a crushed plastic pellet designed one, and that part of the problem is that you can't even replace these old, and you replace these old fields, you almost have to treat it as a hazardous waste material. But that's not.
This is
not
completely recyclable product.
Okay, so do you have the name of the product? So if I go to the website on those other ones, that
yeah, there's
two different.
Yeah, yeah, we can get that.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair.
Thank you. Members, appreciate your time.
Thank you. We'll continue with, we'll start with the out-of-town legislators and their presenters, Representative Lamp from Moorhead. Is it enough to have just the author and one witness testify?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Erickson, I think, wants to also make some.
I think he's spoken enough today.
Okay. You're the boss.
He's a good testifier, but we've heard him. Mm-hmm. If there are questions, that's fine. Okay, go ahead. Welcome, Representative Lanning. House File 2516.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. We in our community and region are very pleased to be chosen by the Amateur Sports Commission as the site of a regional sports facility. Moorhead, the Moorhead area, has hosted a wide variety of sporting activities, both on a regional, statewide, as well as even a national level. And we have a world championship coming to Moorhead in April of 2009. Moorhead is the largest community in the western two-thirds of Minnesota, and so naturally we are clearly a regional center, not only for sporting activities, but for education, arts, and a variety of arts and heritage activities. The proposal that you have before you is for a bonding amount of $4 million. The city of Moorhead, and you have this information in the folder that has been handed out, the city of Moorhead has already made a commitment of $9.2 million for the acquisition of property, municipal infrastructure, site improvements. And the city has already made a commitment to 9 soccer fields. And what this $4 million would do, if it were granted, would be enable us to add another 7 soccer fields so that we would have 16 fields that would be able to attract a lot of soccer activity from throughout the region and even multiple states. Moorhead and Fargo together have been a soccer center for years. We have hosted all kinds of tournaments and have been very successful in doing that. The city of Moorhead has just already started this new park development and, as I said, have already committed $9.2 million. To share a little bit more about what is planned, I'd like to call on Holly Heitkamp, who is the Recreation Division Manager for the City of Moorhead, and she can give you more of the particulars. Welcome, Ms. Heitkamp.
Chair and members of the committee, as Legislative Lanning said, we are hoping to go from 9 fields, which was the replacement of our previous soccer complex, up to 16 fields, which would allow us to bring in a multitude of teams throughout the region. We already host a 100-team tournament in Moorhead on an annual basis, but would like to bring in teams from Winnipeg, Manitoba, up in all throughout Canada, Iowa, South Dakota, and throughout the region into Moorhead so that we can fill our hotels and use our dining so that they can participate and bring tax money into the state of Minnesota. The $4 million, as we said, there's 9 fields, but additional 7 would be added. With that would be an upgraded administrative building, a separate maintenance building, and really the extra parking and amenities that are needed to hold these region-wide tournaments. We feel like we have the capacity with the volunteerism and the community support to make these things happen. We have a proven track record and really would appreciate any support you could give us to take this to the next level and bring people into our part of the state. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you. Next, Bill, another person from out of town. Representative Seifert has a group of people here on House File 2542.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I actually have 2 witnesses that are co-chairs of our local amateur sports commission, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us, by the way. Do they need to move the House File? It'd be House File 2542, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, we're just holding the hearing.
Okay, good.
Do it on Thursday.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, on behalf of the City of Marshall and the surrounding area, I want to present the Southwest Regional Sports Center bill. What this is a modest proposal for $100,000 in pre-designed plans for the only area of the state that really has no has not had a designation until as of recently. This is both an indoor and outdoor facility. He has the support of our local community, the city, the county, the school district, our local university, the chamber, and the Convention Visitors Bureau, the Swan Food Company, and our local sports commission. And there are additional formal endorsements that are coming as well. As many of you know, Marshall has been a regional center for education, business, and sports activities. We are one of the few communities in the southwest part of the state that is growing and have had a proven track record in our community for developing public-private partnerships, including the addition of a brand new high school within the last 2 years, a brand new YMCA within the last 5 years, a new airport terminal, and some of you remember a new event center at our university that is under construction right now. We certainly look forward to any questions you might have. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Jane Willett, who is one of our physicians in town and is co-chair of our amateur sports facility commission, and Roger Madison, who is one of our local bankers, and he's the co-chair with Dr. Willett.
And she can speak for both of them. Huh? Yeah. Welcome, Dr. Willett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee, for having us here today. Marshall community is very excited about being a regional sports center. Southwest Minnesota is a very large area that has very little access to excellent facilities. Right now, Marshall has hosted 70 different tournaments, primarily in basketball, volleyball, dance, and baseball. What we lack are good ice facilities for hockey and other ice sports, and good soccer fields. The two top sports in Minnesota for amateur sports are hockey and soccer, and we do not have adequate facilities in Marshall. We're asking for $100,000 in pre-design money for that. My interest in this is that I'm a physician, and so I'm interested in a healthy community, and you know, all there's an epidemic of obesity. And I'm hoping that by promoting these traditional amateur sports that will reduce that. I'm also an avid sports enthusiast and a basketball, hockey, soccer, baseball, football mom. And I'm tired of traveling all the time to go to all these regional events in other cities and to go to Iowa and South Dakota for these events. It'd be nice if we could still sell us in Minnesota. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. I just want to say that I support this from the economic side of it. It fits into the economic strategies of Southwest Minnesota and Marshall. One of the things we know about the modern family is they expect quality in the things they do. We see this in housing and in education. And one of the pieces that we see in Marshall itself is that drive to quality. This fall we had a levy referendum for operating money that was passed, and not just with just passing, but having both of the questions on that ballot approved by the community, because they do believe in quality. We've stepped to the plate on our own and said we're going to do some things. We believe that this kind of quality stretches to this sports facility, and that it will allow us to attract visitors from out of town, from the South Dakota and Iowa and Nebraska areas in particular. But beyond tourists, I believe that this offers the opportunity to bring in better businesses, more business employers, and employees. We call it recruitment amenities as we look at the things that we compete against within our adjacent neighbors in South Dakota and Iowa, the ability to recruit with better amenities. This proposed site is on the site of the Marshall High School and the Southwest Minnesota State University. Because they are contiguous, it gives us one larger campus to have this tied together. Obviously, it benefits both of those entities as well as the community as a whole. The other benefactor, logically, is the hospitality industry. We currently have almost 70 tournaments a year. We hope to improve that. It will allow us to bring in additional hotels, which is a discussion we've already started with many of the ones that are there for expansion. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Coming.
Yep. Just some kind of, maybe this is for Paul Eric, a little historical perspective. When we did the Mighty Ducks, I don't think we ever stipulated specific places where they would go. And this seems to be, this idea of regional sports centers seems to be a new idea that's coming forward. And I just wondered if instead, and I don't know how many more we're going to have right now, but Right now, we've heard presentations to two of them. If we decide we're not spending them, would it make some sense to have some kind of a grant process run through the Amateur Sports Commission to look at things like local support, you know, to have, do it kind of the way you did the grants to the Mighty Ducks, which not everyone got them at the same time or in the same year. Is that something that could be done?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, I think just as you as a legislature didn't put state universities in 100 different cities, you had to be selective, and the Amateur Sports Commission over the last year and a half has come up with a plan, and the plan is on that map there that came down temporarily, but it's really seven regional centers is the, we think the logical amount to capture that economic development for amateur sports. And if you look at southwest Minnesota, you know, with the state university, with the other quality amenities that are at what the city and the schools have done, it's the logical place to capture that benefit, bringing sports tourists in. Northwest Minnesota, Moorhead is the logical candidate. On the range, we've built several facilities at Giantsburg and so on. Rochester is the logical southeast. Now, you notice that the largest facility at Blaine, 55 soccer fields, soccer and hockey bring the greatest economic development. More soccer and hockey families travel probably than any other sport. So we want those, we want regionally significant facilities, 16 fields in Moorhead, 10 to 12 in Marshall, and Rochester, by the way, does have some good soccer complexes. Southwest site, because of the deficiency that Marshall has in ice facilities, they have a very dated pole barn on the county fairgrounds, I believe, that we're, it's really not just an ice arena, it's a, you know, 12-field complex with a building that can have up to two ice seats and other sports. So it's really something that's really a step bigger and more like supportive of the entire regional center there. I mean, it's possible that the ice facility could be, you know, sectioned out and fall under a Mighty Ducks grant program, and I think that we're certainly going to look at that. But for now, it's the emphasis on regional centers that can attract that out-of-state visitor. And I think that's where the where our board, when it designated Marshall, was looking at fixing the deficiencies in the field sport soccer and in hockey. And by the way, at the committee's leisure, we won't go through a bit of time, but we did a formal professional study with the University of Minnesota Tourism Center on a market assessment study for Marshall, Minnesota, which we sent it out to 1,000 sport representatives in 10 sports. And it confirmed that people saw Marshall. I think 70% of the respondents said they would come to Marshall to compete in these tournaments. So we're on the right track as far as our research.
So I guess the answer to my question is, I was just using the Mighty Ducks as an example of how you had in a sense, already done the preliminary work of studying, and that's what gave you the rating of Moorhead as number three and Marshall as number four.
You are correct.
And then the others. And I was going to see the others.
You'll see them later today, yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But we've been working on them for several years.
Okay.
Any other questions? You bet. I'm having a paper overload here. I don't know if I'm in the only one in that boat, but the next one is House File 2703. Duck in green jacket. Appropriation for Lake Superior Mississippi Railroad Scenic Railway. Representative Yellis, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Lord. Thank you. We have some
And Representative Yaros has got one speaker, and
yes,
he's ready to state his name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, Lake Superior Mississippi Railroad Association is a tourist train run by dedicated volunteers. They don't get any government help from anybody. All they need is to fix their tracks, because the train is going to come to a stop if they're not done. So this is why they have gotten some money from the state about 10 years ago, and they're back to do the job again. This is Mr. Andrew Webb is the president of the association, and he will give you a brief presentation about the bill.
Fire away if you want to state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Andrew Webb. I'm one of the volunteers with the Lake Superior Mississippi Railroad. This year I happen to be a railroad president, so when you go home tonight you can tell your spouse that you talked to a railroad president. To give you a little bit of background about our railroad, the Lake Superior and Mississippi Railroad, the original railroad was a land-grant railroad organized by the Minnesota State Legislature in 1863. And its grant, if you will, was to build a railroad from the Mississippi River in St. Paul to Duluth, Minnesota, hence the name Lake Superior and Mississippi. However, due to the U.S. Civil War, work did not get started until 1865, building the track and right-of-way. By August 1st of 1870, they had reached Duluth, and they proceeded then to start doing business, shipping freight, passengers, and so forth. However, as a railroad company, they were somewhat underfunded, and they weren't able to buy very powerful locomotives. So if you'll fast forward to 100 years later, 1970, there was only 5 miles of track left because basically more powerful locomotives had been developed that could go steeper hills, more direct routes. And then the two industries of what we call in the track, one burned down and the other closed. So that 5 miles of track, that historical track, if you will, the first railroad into Duluth, was up for abandonment. At that point, a couple of groups of local rail fans got together and they established a 501c3 nonprofit company to operate a tourist train on that 5 miles. We've done a little bit better than our predecessor. We're now getting ready to start our 28th season of operating a tourist train in West Duluth. And at this point, I should point out to you that Duluth is fortunate enough to have two tourist railroads. Of course, we think we're nicer because our hearts are pure. But there is another one downtown that you may or may not be aware of. The St. Paul Pioneer Press travel editor has quoted the LS&M, or Lake Superior and Mississippi Railroad, as being the most scenic train ride in the state of Minnesota, as it wanders along the St. Louis River in West Duluth. I have to agree with her because I think I've ridden just about all the others, and ours is very, very scenic. We need this influx of money, if you will, because there's only about 22 volunteers, of which only about 7 are really able-bodied, if you will, to swing a spike maul and pounding a spike into the tie. By the way, I can fully attest, folks, to the fact that swinging a spike maul and hitting a railroad spike and driving it home is excellent cardiovascular exercise. If any of you would like to come up and help us out with some track work, I'm sure that I can find a spike maul that will fit your hands, believe me. So what we need is, while we meet Federal Railroad Administration Class 1 standards, that's the minimum that we have. What we'd like to do is get our track up beyond the minimum. And what we need to do is hire a company to come in and do the track work for us and just get it done. And so now we're finished with it. You should also note that a properly installed railroad tie will last somewhere between 40 and 50 years. So don't expect to see us back in the next 40 years. What we try to do also as a railroad is, if you do come out and ride our train, is we try to recreate train travel as it was in the 1870s and the 1880s. Our coaches are not heated, they're not air conditioned. If you're riding a train on a hot day, you open the window and take off your jacket. If you're riding a train on a cold day, leave the window down and button up. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Hey, Mr. Webb, I and Representative Yaros, I neglected to see that there's an amendment to the bill. Can we just go about incorporating that really quick? Do you want to move the 81 amendment to House File 2703?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, that's just an amendment to say that it would be bonding rather than general fund, because we don't have general fund.
Okay. I can't imagine we have any controversy on this amendment. If we just want to go ahead with that, all those in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 2703, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes. I need to gavel once today. The amendment is adopted. Any questions to Bill? I have one. This is for ties. Are these wood, high density polyethylene? What kind of stuff do you use?
Right now we're planning on grade 3 wood.
Okay. I work in recycling and I always like to see where our milk jugs are going.
Well, some of the cost the also is not only in the purchase of the tile, but the shipping to it, the installation of it, and the disposal of the used tile. They are considered a hazardous material.
And you have to absorb the cost for that as well?
The whole thing, yes, sir.
Okay.
I could say we don't receive any subsidies from the city of St. Louis County or the state. We managed to bootstrap ourselves along for 28 years. We're kind of proud of that. The city gets a second source railroad grant. It's just an issue for everybody on Saturdays and Sundays. But, if the labor is lost.
Very good. Other question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Webb, I'm impressed that you haven't taken subsidies. You've been basically doing it on your own. Of course, the Empire builder, James J. Hill, operated similarly. We recently toured his home on Summit Avenue and was wondering if you had a similar home on Skyline Drive.
No, sir, I did not. They claim as a railroad president I should actually get my private passenger coach. I'm still waiting for that one.
Well, Representative Burdall, you can always come up to my district in North Oaks and visit James J. Hill's former experimental farm. And, but you have to come with me. You can't go yourself because you might be escorted out. So, any other comments, Representative Yarris?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And there's another volunteer here, Bob Johansson, who came with President Webb. He's been a volunteer for almost 10 years already.
One of our qualified engineers. Well, we may be a volunteer for the railroad. We have to meet all the federal requirements. We have a federally approved engineer training program. We're getting ready to step up to something in the March. That's Representative Yarrow, if you know what I'm doing. And after you do qualify as an engineer, you get a chance to enter the Oak the Horn. How many engineers do you have? We have 9. And we basically run about, not counting charters, about 38 days a year. This is today. So we're kind of tight. I'd like to have twice that many.
I don't think ethics rules will allow you to get higher than number 10 if you want to be added to that. Any other questions? Thanks very much, Mr. Webb, and thanks for putting all that sweat equity behind your request. Let's see. Next up, House File 6024, Representative Norton. And if you give us a moment, we can locate that bill on the back here. House File 624, Representative Norton. Good afternoon. How are you?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
That's all the idle tips that I have, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll make it short and pass along to a couple other guests I have with me today. I'm very pleased to present the National Volleyball Center bill. It's the number one priority of the state agency. You've heard from the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission several times already today. This is a statewide project, but its roots have already begun in Rochester. First and foremost, this facility is part of Minnesota's sports tourism plans for Southeast Minnesota. And for those of you that have been around for a while, you'll remember, I don't know if anyone here has been here this long, in 1987, Governor Perkins had a vision for sports in this state, and this was part of that vision. The National Volleyball Center is a proven host of regional, national, and international volleyball participants. Since the building opened, we've had 445,000 people walk through its doors, but we've got room to grow, and that's what we're going to talk about today. The legislature approved $2.3 million in 1996 for this project. The request was for $5 million, and it was supposed to be a $7.3 million project at that time. But again, 2.3 was what was appropriated, and with a 50% match from our area. Also, the House and Senate have approved this project several times, and it actually passed the entire legislative body at one point, but was vetoed by a past governor. And we hope that that will not be the case this year. The $4 million final phase, as we're calling it, will complete this project. Its time has come. It's long overdue. We have 5,000 hotel rooms in the city of Rochester, which are used by primarily Mayo Clinic visitors during the week, but on the weekends they're ready for other business, and we can fill them if we get this project complete. I have Seb Stewart with me, and Seb, I will let you explain the rest of the project, and if you have questions, we have several other folks here that would be happy, including Paul Erickson, to address your
concerns. Thank you, Representative Norton.
And welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and affiliation.
Yes, my name is Howard Stewart. They call me Chubb Stewart, and I won't explain why. But I'm the vice chairman of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, and I've been there 18 years. When the original legislation was passed by the state in 1987, the intent was to create for Minnesota a national training center for every Olympic sport, winter and summer. And the legislation was very specific. It said that in order to build these facilities, the communities that were so designated by the state must build them in accordance with the Olympic guidelines, and that you had to work with the national governing body of each individual sport. Rochester was picked in 1989 to be the volleyball center, and we started out immediately working with the national folks at in Colorado Springs, the U.S. Olympic Committee on Volleyball, and USA Volleyball, which is a national governing body, to design the facility. And that was a $7.3 million facility that Representative Norton referred to. Unfortunately, at the last minute of the legislative session, rather than getting the $5 million that we anticipated, we got $2.3 million, and we literally had to strip from the design all of the features that made it a national volleyball center. We took out locker rooms, we took out the medical room for the injuries, and we have tournaments every weekend in Rochester, and we have injuries every weekend, ankles, knees, and so forth. Medical people are there, but we don't have a medical room to handle them. We had to take out the media room that was specified by the U.S. Olympic Committee. We had to take out room for coaches, referees, and a training room where athletes could go in and see on a video display the characteristics of their play that needed correcting. And all of that was stripped out, and we ended up with a volleyball facility that was world class in terms of the floor and the general construction, but the amenities that made it what you folks in the legislature asked for, a Olympic training facility, did not happen. And as Representative Norton said, we were in the bill a few years ago and got vetoed, line item vetoed out, as many of you will remember what happened 4 or 5 years ago when that happened. So we're back to finish the project that we were asked to do. And there's a lot of money laying on the tables that we can bring into the state of Minnesota. I have one article here from the 2005 edition of Sporting Events, a national news magazine that deals with sports. And the headlines say, Salt Lake City home court to USA Volleyball 205 Girls Championships. And reads, for the third time in 5 years, the USA Volleyball has chosen Salt Lake City to host one of its premier Junior Olympic national training events, the 2005 USA Junior Olympic Volleyball Championships, which is scheduled to be played in the city from June 28th to July 6th. 800 of the best junior volleyball players from every state and nation will be in attendance. Utah Sports Commission President Jeff Robbins said the upcoming event is expected to bring 40,000 to 50,000 people into the city, making it the largest sporting event held in Utah outside of the 2002 Olympic Winter Games. The annual event will showcase girls aged 12 to 18 competing daily in numerous divisions, and is expected to draw about 300 college coaches and recruiters seeking future team players. We are this community, the state, that is the center of volleyball. And we should have had in 1996, when we got the funding and built the building in 1998, a building that would have met the requirements, that would have allowed us to compete successfully, and we are way ahead of the curve. Had we had our building, we would have been bidding for, and we would have been successful on this type of activity. We have repeatedly kept in touch with USA Volleyball. We've repeatedly kept in touch with the National Olympic Committee in Colorado Springs. I've been there many times and visited the volleyball facility. And they will talk to us if we can finish the building and put in the amenities that will bring this kind of business to Minnesota. And as an ex-businessman, I know where the money is. It's for those good folks in the other states that want to come here, and let's get together and attract them here, and let's finish the project, and we appreciate your listening. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative Medora.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on the, not even on particularly on this project, but you seem like an expert, or as the vice chair, you can answer this. Is there any requirement that this group give money back to the local communities in form of after-school programs, free and reduced opportunities for kids to play on these fields, perhaps to sponsor a local team? You know, it's great that we are putting a lot of money in, or we're looking at developing this, but we also have a huge number of children that are unable to participate because of the cost constraints. So does this organization give back, and how much do they give back?
Yes, we do. And I'm going to ask Ron Bastian, who is the director of our Parks and Recreation Department, to give you some idea of the kinds of activities that take place in the community with volleyball, because we are giving back. As a matter of fact, the Rochester Amateur Sports Commission, which I'm also a member of, we raise money within our community and we give it to charity, and we give it to particularly young children who cannot afford to go out for hockey or go out for volleyball or wherever. They can't pay the fees, they can't travel. We take care and we pay that. But we have much more than the Olympic program. We have the entire community in southeast Minnesota and all throughout the state are using these facilities. Ron, can you add anything to that?
And Mr. Chair, while Ron comes back, could I just add, if you want to know more of economic impact, this particular project has already had a great economic impact, and Paul Erickson can speak to that. But for some of you that are new, you might not be aware that this particular project, and maybe Ron can speak to it too, was built attached to the high school that was built at the same time. So there have been collaborations from the very beginning, and in fact, part of the idea was, well, we'll use the locker rooms for the high school, and those will serve as locker rooms for the volleyball center. Well, as any of you know, if you have an active high school in your community, sharing a locker room on a weekend is almost impossible, and that's led to, really needing to come back and ask you for the rest. But here's Ron Bastian from our Park and Rec Department.
Again, Ron Bastian, Director of Parks and Recreation, City of Rochester. Representative Norton just kind of answered the question of that. We do a cooperative effort with the school district on this program. This facility is used 7 days a week, 7 a.m. in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. There's all sorts of programs, after-school programs, SAC programs that come through this facility and utilize that. So I think we're doing that through our program and our association with the school district.
Representative Medora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not specific to this project. Please don't. I think this is a great idea. I'm just wondering, though, as we're looking at setting up regional centers, we had a minority leader in here earlier asking for bonding money to do this. I'm kind of concerned to be sure that we're giving back to the community. We're going to be generating these kind of state dollars. So that's really my concern with that. It's not specific to this project, so thank you.
Very good. Other questions from the committee? All right. We'll move on. I was just... I'm on the environment committees, and I was just double-checking on Minnesota Statute 115A.151 that all public entities are required to recycle at least 3 materials. I mean, I do edit blame. But I'm going to ask that question when we make all these things. Okay. Next up, we have a couple members who have to get moving to other committees. Representative Cornish, House File 2739. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cornish. Good afternoon. Oh, I should have started with the back. Welcome to the committee, and fire away on House File 2739. I've been getting a constituent email on one of your bills. Representative Johnson was sort of making light of that a little bit. Okay. Good afternoon. Please proceed.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, what I have here is a bond proceed request for the pre-design for the renovation of the Wells Historical Society's depot down there. They have a depot in Wells, as you know, all over rural Minnesota. There are a number of depots and they're vanishing, and these folks here want to restore this one. I know time is short here, so I'll introduce Mike Beckman from Wells, who's on the board of the Wells Historical Society and has been in to this project from the start, and we'll give you a briefing on it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the tape, please.
Mike Beckman, I'm Vice President of the Wells Historical Society, also a board member. I want to thank you for your time. We've taken over the depot, purchased from the IC&E back in 2006, and we're presently working on fundraising for the reservation of the depot. We plan on turning it into a museum. This will happen probably in late 2009 or 2010, providing we get some funding. We're here asking for your support to help us in this endeavor. We want to turn it into a museum and something of a transportation museum and also an area museum for the people of the surrounding city of Wells. That's basically it. We are a 501c3 organization. We've applied for other grants, and I don't know, that's about all I got.
Is there any matching funds locally at all, or volunteer labor?
Yes, we are all volunteers, and we just succeeded in having a pancake breakfast yesterday morning. I didn't see anybody there, but anyway, we had a good turnout, and we're raising money that way. We also have applied for grants through MnDOT and also a grant through the Minnesota Historical Society. Pretty good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cornish, how much is the cost of the project total as far as the overall?
About $300,000 is what the total project has come to.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't help but... Representative Cornish, do you have a black, wide-brimmed black hat to wear with that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And today, so far, I've been called Black Bart 7 times and White Earp about 13. Mr. Chair, members, I've been pretty upfront with your administrator and staff about there's been some difficulties here with this request and trying to find out what publicly owned means and a number of interpretations. It's kind of like Farm America that I had to qualify for bonding. What we're trying to do now is go back to the City of Wells and see how much involvement they want to have in taking over the project. So there are some intricacies that we have to work out here. So this is more informational than anything. And you might see this project come up again in another bill for outright appropriation. But I just wanted to make the committee aware of that we've got some work to do on this. And thank you very much for your time today. I was at the pancake breakfast, and they've got a lot of volunteer and summon calendars and this and that, so they've really got the team involved.
Representative Rudolph.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in more serious vein, I think it's very important to look at these old depots and preserve them as well as we can. I really regret that Litchfield had a nice big brick railroad depot that was torn down, and to see some of these depots and the buildings torn down, I think is a travesty, and we should look at restoring them and repairing them whenever we can.
Yeah, the depot was built in 1903, and it's still standing, but no thanks to the railroad, they have neglected it quite a bit. So the roof is really collapsing, so something.
We could move it to Fridley on the north side. We're missing it.
Yeah. It's 90 feet long. Good luck.
Very good. Other questions for the committee? Thank you, Mr. Beckman and Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
And keep us posted also. Thank you. Representative Hackbar, thank you for waiting. House file 1965.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could get somebody to move the bill, and then I'm going to have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that we're going to have to adopt.
Okay. But we have to make the amendment.
I have to get somebody to move the bill and the amendment.
Would anyone, Representative Peterson, move House File 1965? Did you want to move the amendment as well, Representative Peterson? Representative Peterson moved the 1965 A1 amendment
Any explanation needed on the amendment?
Just to get the bill in the shape that I'd like, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
Point.
Very good. Let's just act on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Okay, that's great. Representative Hackworth, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. The original bill was a bonding proposal for the Oliver H. Kelly Farm historic site in the city of Elk River, and it was for $8 million, which included planning and design money and to possibly have a new visitor center built there. The Capital Investment Committee was at the site a few months ago, and I think folks were pretty impressed and didn't realize exactly what the Kelly Farm consisted of. So with that, Mr. Chairman, what we've done is scaled back the bill to from $8 million to $1.5 million for design and pre-design work and to build kind of a picnic kind of an area at the facility with money that might be left over from those funds. So with that, I have a number of folks here, but I have Mr. Clint Larson, who is with the Friends of the Kelly Farm, that has been instrumental in keeping the farm open even in very difficult economic times when we didn't have funding to keep it open. The Friends of the Kelly Farm did keep it open with private funds, and we're sitting pretty good today. But we are also looking for additional money from the private sector, and they're constantly doing that sort of thing. But I'd like to have Mr. Larson say a few words at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. If you could just state your full name and the affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Clint Larson. I'm president of the Friends of the Kelly Farms. It's a 501c volunteer support group. We're dedicated to promote, evaluate, and sponsor farm activities. It's a working group using our hands, minds to benefit what I believe is a very valuable state treasure. And the reason it is that its primary purpose is education. I've been a sponsor of education throughout my life and in part part of my retirement. I found that to be effective, an educational institution must have knowledge. It must grow its knowledge and effectively transfer the knowledge to others. In our case, the 12,000 school children and 58,000 visitors who come to the site every year. The most effective way to learn is to do, and that's what the site is all about. In our universities, we have laboratories where we practice what we're exposed to. At the Kelly Farm, we take our knowledge of agricultural heritage, and we transfer that knowledge to our students in a fashion that shows how the work was done in the 1860s. Our students actively participate in farm activities. And I think it's important to note that the farm activities change on a yearly, seasonal basis. In the fall, we do the harvesting. In the spring, we do the planting. During the year, we do the seasonal cooking. And we do this all with the equipment, techniques, and knowledge that existed in the 1860s. It's truly a living history farm. This is not a static site. It is a very dynamic site. The opportunity for the visitors to participate is extremely important because it gains knowledge, and the knowledge, I think, is retained. And as a result, the curiosity of particular school students is enhanced, and they move forward and learn more. I believe it not only teaches about the farm, but it teaches about the ability to keep on learning. The site is indeed a state treasure, but it needs your help. It has a good working site in terms of the site itself. The visitors' amenities, however, are seriously lacking. I don't know how many of you have had the opportunity to entertain a busload of 200, busloads of 200 or so children who have had a long bus ride and are trying to go to a single bathroom for each sex. It's an interesting challenge that needs some improvement. We need to know our visitor amenities. We need it not only to assure that our visitors have a comfortable experience, but to enhance the learning experience. Because we have very few opportunities in our lifetime to visit our history, our heritage, and to communicate that to the growing generation. I grew up on a farm similar to the Kelly farm. That tells you how old I am. And I would not want the children exposed on a daily basis to this, but to understand the values of what took place in those years is a very valuable experience. I think we can all relate to that. I think those of you who have the opportunity or will have the opportunity to visit the farm can relate to the need for a few more comfort speakers in our visitor center. So I'm sure that we have something tremendous to offer. The group, the Friends, is doing its best to make this a ongoing, valuable educational institution, and we look forward to your help as we continue that effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. I was noticing in what I just got handed, the Historical Society's capital budget request of 2008. This is on page 14. I had a quick question. When you describe revitalization, well, I was going to say, very sneaky nap, you know, with all this. But my daughter's school is on here. She's going.
Oh, good.
She's visited in Pink Potato. And actually, it's very similar to how her great-grandparents' experience was in South Dakota, so it was actually a very great experience for her. But I'm hearing about restrooms, but what other stuff fits under revitalization and renewal of the site?
Well, certainly the restrooms are a key part of it, but the entire visitor center needs renewal. It's been around a long time, and perhaps that Mr. Quist could answer that question a lot more comprehensively than I do. He's the manager of the site.
I don't know if we need to go over too much of it, but
okay.
The visitor center is what you're...
But the visitor center needs replacing, absolutely.
Okay. Quite a few folks have
been around a long time, but the urgent thing is the visitor amenities. But we need to enhance the site to attract, as so many others here are looking for, more visitors to the site to make it a more viable business proposition, as well as continue its educational value.
Great. Any questions for the committee? Well, I'm glad you're not pursuing authentic bathroom experiences.
thank you.
Very good, Representative Ackworth. Any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have Mr. Quist here, the manager of the site, and Mr. Kelleher, if there are any further questions in regard to this. But the money is for design and pre-design of a new government center, or a new visitor center, and we do need to do some immediate work to improve the restroom situation and the picnic area. And this would go a long way to do that.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, and we'll, as with all these bills, we're going to use over for potential...
Thanks for your consideration.
...consideration to our recommendations of the council.
Thank you very much.
Let's see, Representative Faust. House file 2646. And this is also in a green jacket, so I have to fumble near the bottom. The bottommost green one. Golly. Welcome to the committee, Representative Faust. Tell us about House File 2646.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We didn't start out at $8 million request for this. We started at $40,000, and that's where we're staying. It's one of your cheaper projects, but also one of your more important ones. We do have an issue with this project as far as the ownership of the property goes. Senator Laurie is working on that, and we believe that we should get that resolved fairly soon.
Under nonprofit ownership, is that the deal? Or
well, everyone believes that about 100 years ago, the land was given to the state of Minnesota from the church that owned the cemetery, and that was the belief. That, I mean, everyone understood that to be the case until it came time to prove that. And nobody has been able to prove that, and so we're still looking at options to find ways to prove that that is the case.
So somebody has a deed in their best pocket somewhere. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, please go ahead.
So there's two options. One is that we can either prove that the state has it or have the state get title for it somehow, or we can go with general revenue monies rather than regular bond monies. But so those are issues that we are still working on, and we believe that they should be resolved fairly quickly, but just in case, we would need to go to
general revenue money instead of the regular bond. So anyway, I have with me the Hinckley City Administrator, Jim Osmus, and also the Hinckley Fire Monument Restoration Committee Chair, I believe, Sandy Hines, and I will turn it over to her to let her explain the situation and why this is such an important thing.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. If you want to just state your full name and your affiliation for the day, please.
I'm Sandra Hines. I'm the manager of the Hinckley Fire Museum and a spokesperson for the Light the Night Committee, which was formed to take care of the problem of the condition of the Hinckley Fire Monument that's on the outskirts of our city. Many people that will testify to this committee will be asking for new money to be included in the bonding bill. We, however, are requesting funds for work not done in the year 2000. Let me explain. In 1900, a monument was built by the state of Minnesota on the east side of Hinckley to commemorate the Great Hinckley Fire of 1894. This is where one of the issues of ownership comes in. In 1894, we have 246 dead, unidentified bodies on the edge of town after the Great Hinckley Fire of 1894. The state commandeered the land because you had to have the bodies buried. They were unidentified, so they couldn't be put in individual sites. They were put in a mass grave. The monument is located on the edge of that mass grave from the Great Hinckley Fire of 1894. This is where the paperwork went awry. We do have information from the Swedish Lutheran Church that the land was commandeered by the state and they received compensation of $300 for that to help rebuild their church after this great fire of 1894. So you can see how the paperwork would get a little mucked up because it was necessary to get those people interred quickly. All right, now, in the year 2000, the most recent of a number of requests were made by a group of citizens from Hinckley. We approached the Historical Society of Minnesota and asked to take steps to conserve and repair the monument, which is owned by the state of Minnesota and is under their care. The process began. You have to understand now, this is your monument. I'm here as a spokesperson on behalf of a big granite monument which cannot speak for itself. And because it is your monument, it's your responsibility to fix it. So says the monument. Okay, now, the 2000 bonding bill included funds to repair various state historical markers and monuments. At that time, you'll see included in your packet, the State Historical Preservation Field Services and Grants Department wrote to us saying, quote, we're now in the process of fine-tuning the plan for this appropriation and obtaining estimates for the needed repairs. I will get back to you when the work plan is completed and there is more information to report, unquote. It's been 8 years and nobody got a hold of it. So we kind of have a feeling it's not going to happen. In 2005, the Minnesota Historical Society hired a conservation firm, Conservation Solutions Incorporated, Washington, D.C., to evaluate and offer treatment recommendations for the Hinckley Fire Museum Fire Monument, along with 26 other Minnesota monuments. At that time, the monument's condition was rated poor to fair, and the consultants recommended immediate repairs because they feared catastrophic loss. Blocks together has fallen apart and it's coming down the side of the monument, and granite pavers along the base of the monument have become a tripping hazard for visitors. Last year, the Historical Society sent out a representative to meet with the members of the Hinckley community. These were forming the Light the Night Committee. The manager of Outreach Services Historic Preservation Department, Timothy Glines, came to Hinckley at the request of the Light the Night Committee, which had been established to improve and upgrade the Veterans Memorial, light the Hinckley Fire Monument from dusk until dawn, and landscape the whole area. Other than permission to illuminate the monument, no commitments were made and no action was taken. This is not a small monument. It's 52 feet tall and it weighs 60 tons. you know, when you think about historical monuments in Minnesota, you're often thinking about something 4 feet by 5 feet, a nice piece of granite. This is an obelisk. It's a very large 60-ton piece of granite. The estimated cost to repair is $40,000. The monument has deteriorated further in the past 3 years since this report, and it requires immediate attention for both aesthetic and safety reasons. Now, the members of your committee might rightly ask what the community of Hinckley is doing in their commitment to this monument and their part to support this effort. I want you to know that we have. That Light Tonight Committee in 2007, members of the Hinckley Fire Museum, the VFW, the American Legion, the Lions Club, the City of Hinckley, and many other citizens raised $20,000. Now we're talking about a town of 1,200 people. And people sent money from other parts of the country even. All right. With $20,000 and $20,000 of donated labor, we fixed up all around the fire monument. New flagpoles, lighting for the monument, monuments lit dusk to dawn every day. The cost of it is being absorbed by the museum, by the VFW, by the American Legion to illuminate this marvelous monument. We have a refurbished gazebo, we have new painted posts and chains, concrete sidewalks, landscaping with trees and bushes and flowers and benches. We had people from the local flower companies, we had flower clubs working to fix this up. We put in benches so that the visitors can sit and contemplate the historic significance of this site. And there's a winding walkway that ends right at the still deteriorating monument. To recap, the monument is the property and responsibility of the state. We can't arbitrarily say, we're going to fix the monument. It doesn't belong to us. All right? It has been evaluated by experts who called for immediate repairs. The community has already invested $40,000 of its own to refurbish the site surrounding the monument. So we believe that it's time for the state of Minnesota to do its part with a specific allocation of funds and the force of law to act so that this historic site may be preserved. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I ask you today to appropriate the necessary funds with specific instructions from the Minnesota Historical Society's Historic Preservation Office to complete the repairs in a timely manner. Because, of course, every year the deterioration continues. There is also, I have included a number of written documents, the Historical Society's previous communication, expert evaluations, the condition materials. It's there for your inspection. And this concludes my prepared remarks, and I yield the rest of the time for any questions that you may have. And I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. This is a historic fire. It's no small thing. A 4.5-mile-high firewall, visible as far away as Mason City, Iowa, into Wisconsin, all the way to the South Dakota border. A 4.5-mile fire of tornadoes of fire. To give you some perspective of our Great Hinckley Fire in comparison to one most recently, the one in the Boundary Waters. The Boundary Waters fire burned 76,000 acres, and it took 2 weeks. The Great Hinckley Fire, a firestorm, a very unusual kind of fire, burned 300,000 acres into four counties in 4 hours.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Any questions?
Well, you did a good job explaining. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
It's a small amount in comparison with 22 million of this and 45 million of that. But where can we go? We have to come to you because it's your monument, and we do want to take you care of. We are concerned about the lives.
If we raise taxes, we'll be able to do everything, fund everything.
Oh, sir, I know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I want to apologize to Representative Gunther and Olin. The schedule, when I talked to them, the schedule said one thing, and then I see it was changed, and I'm sorry. Representative Gunther, you're next. House File 900.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 900 is a relatively cheap bill compared to what the rest of you might have heard about.
28,000?
No, 18.
Oh,
18. This is for the Ceylon Youth Baseball Field, and Ceylon is a town of 413 population, and it has senior citizens and ball players, and they play in the co-ed baseball league, and they're the only team that doesn't have lights, and there are not many co-ed baseball teams in southern Minnesota, and in order to be able to accommodate the other teams and be part of this league, it's essential this community has light to the baseball. And they have many good ball players, I know that. I used to have a tug of war contest, and Ceylon always won, so I never wanted to smart out the people from Ceylon. But this is, I have the youngest mayor ever in the history of Minnesota here, John Jabot. And you all see the brochure we sent out. This is one of the places Walter Mondale called home when he was a young man. And Mayor DeBoe is here to add a little color.
Yes.
Welcome, Mayor DeBoe.
Thank you. John DeBoe, Mayor of Ceylon. Just want to say for the record, Elmore often claims Walter Mondale as their favorite son. We take a little offense to that, but that being said, in 2003, there was a real void in Ceylon, or in Martin County in general, for a co-ed, any type of recreational league for youth and adults. I took the reins on that, and we were able to establish at that point a 22-team league. And this is in a town of a little over 400 people. The league itself is fully supported by the user fees. We put $12,000-$13,000 into the field maintenance itself to try and upgrade the facilities. We feel as a city that we've contributed quite a bit to try and make this be sustainable. We're asking for $18,000, which I wish I would ask for $2 or $3 million, but sounds like 18 is a good number, and we're going to contribute the additional $13,000-$14,000. And we asked for the money last year. We didn't include the increase of the project because we feel like we need to take responsibility for our portion, what we're going to gain out of it, so that we continue to ask for 18 and leave it at that amount. So.
Well, thank you, Chairman. Representative Erdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mayor. It's good that you didn't ask for $2 million when you only needed $18,000. Otherwise, you might be running for the legislature. But
I was soundly defeated, for the record. Learned my lesson.
I was just wondering. I see the age is 16 to 50 for the softball.
Right.
Why do we cut off at 50?
Well, we've just never had anybody older than that ask. I mean, we're open. We say 16 to 50. I just list that as age range for people who have participated.
So if I move there, I could play?
Absolutely. You play first base because we need a first base.
Ah, okay.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now I got to go to one of my two committees. I'm going to miss yours, but I have to go to local media.
Yeah.
Environment.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Rip Olin, I'm sorry. Probably his, your witnesses came from farther, didn't they?
Yes, Representative Chuck. Yaros, they probably did, like about 375 miles.
I'm sorry. Welcome, Rhythm Olin.
So what I have with me is about six different people, not all of which will testify, but I'll introduce them here quickly. But first, this is about the Badger Indoor Ice Arena. Now, when we speak Badger Indoor Ice Arena, we're not talking about a hockey arena because they don't have a hockey arena. Up till now, the history of Badger City has been an outdoor arena. They haven't even had anything indoor for hockey or for any ice skating at all. So this They already have $167,750, and that's what they're asking the state for. So it is an even state match. With me today is Dave Christensen, also known as Pete. He's Badger Area Arena Association Chairman. Jim Rindy, Mayor. Mitch Rammel, member of the committee. Jim Christensen, Arena Secretary, Treasurer, and School Board member. Pam Monstrude, the Badger City Clerk, and her husband. And at this time, I'll call on Dave Christensen.
Welcome, Mr. Christensen. I apologize again.
Oh, thank you, Chairman. Again, my name is Dave Christensen. I'm Chairman of the Badger Area Arena Association. My employment is with Northwest Community Action as a Housing and Weatherization Director. Our story actually goes back quite a ways, back to 2001 when the city of Roseau, which is located 12 miles east of Badger on Highway 11, donated their north rink to Badger with the stipulation that would get it down in a certain period of time so they could erect their new facility and then allow for, with our intention then was to put it up right away with using their existing beams and new steel. We applied for a Mighty Ducks grant in March of 2002 and were denied. So that full amount, that was for the full amount. And, well, that kind of slowed down our progress a little bit, but it didn't slow down our intentions. Our committee was formed in June of 2003. We obtained a certificate of incorporation. We received tax exempt status in September 2004, and we are now a 501c3. And we've had ongoing fundraising to raise that half, matching half, and with more pledged once the project is underway. Our committee has researched other arenas in the area, obtained valuable information in the areas of scheduling, maintenance costs, and design. They've been active in fundraising and recently received a $20,000 grant from the Hart Foundation in Thief River Falls. We've received a total of $70,000 in cash and then within count, like I say, matched that match of $167,000. Bids have been secured for the entire 60 by 176 foot arena, including a 24 by 160 foot addition that will include an entryway, mechanical service areas, restroom, dressing areas, and concession area. Because Badger has shown population growth due mainly to the employment opportunities at Polaris Industries and Marvin Windows, we feel the need to provide immediate recreational facilities to accommodate this growth. The need for an ice skating facility and multi-purpose activity center in the summer when the ice is out is great in this area. Spring and summer activities could include a number of things, including baseball and football practices. The location of this facility is right next to our existing baseball diamond and football field, and the school has, Badger Area School has plans to, right now they have a non-functioning, virtually, concession stand and porta-potty serving as their bathroom facilities. So this would eliminate that need and the expense going into those facilities. So, please consider this worthwhile project when you're distributing your bonding funds. It would be greatly appreciated by the Badger community. I don't know if you know where we're located. I mentioned, you know, where Roseau is. I could say we have 9 months of winter. You know, it's been especially brutal this year, but we feel not only are recreational facilities lacking in general in that area, but winter ones as well. And I guess as a committee member and with my employment at Northwest Community Action, I see a number of latchkey kids through the factories of multi-shifts that virtually have nothing to do. And they need to get out of those TV sets and in front of the video games and get out and do some healthy things. So appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Representative
Tom? Yes. I guess this might be too much, Chairman, but if we're going to do a Mighty Ducks program, wouldn't it be appropriate to have proposals like this just go through the Mighty Ducks program and not then be singled out to be separately done?
This proposal, as is the HALOC one I'll discuss in a minute, are both here because Mighty Ducks wasn't funded. Had you funded that, they probably neither one would have had been here.
We do have a Mighty Ducks close it before?
That is a consideration, but at the time that these proposals were made, there wasn't any Mighty Ducks bill, and nor had it been funded for a few years. Okay. In fact, I think the reason they're probably denied is the money was running out at the time they applied in 2002, originally.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. Also, I've had ongoing emails and dialogue with Senator Stump, Representative Maxine Tennis, who was my high school classmate, and seeking funding, and also, even telling her of our media concerns and trying to speed this project up along, and basically that's thanks to Representative Olin for getting where we are today.
Chairman.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Again, just checking out, and I don't know if maybe both of you, are these both to be two-seat arenas? How many seats of ice are proposed?
One. This is a single ice, indoor ice skating facility with the emphasis on ice skating. We have, in addition to the faculty figures that are available at your disposal here as far as in-kind contributions and project funding, we also have at least six or seven support letters from the author or the CEO of Polaris, well, not Tom Tiller, but Mark Carl, and also Superintendent of the Badger School, Presidents of Citizens State Bank, Board of State Bank.
Maybe the question is to be asked of Mr. Erickson, but don't you have a preference for a DCC facility for economic reasons?
In case of Badger,
I do know, for example, one of the very few one-sheet facilities was funded not quite in my district, but close to it, and I thought it was essentially an economic failure. And that part of the thing was the idea that it was one-sheet instead of two.
I would guess that the population of Badger and the population of this area would use a one-sheet will suffice, because if probably is others in the area, but not in the city of Badger itself, because there isn't any right there.
I don't know if Mr. Erickson would like to comment on the concept of one seat versus two seats.
Chairman, Representative Kahn, you are correct, Representative Kahn, that in the criteria that the legislature approved and our board approved, that it was a competitive process and applicants got extra points if they involved more than one unit of government and if they went to multiple seats. However, so that part is correct. But in Greater Minnesota, and I'll use an example, Bagley, Minnesota received a grant, and a two-seat arena for some of these smaller rural communities would not be practical, so that the only solution will be a single seat. I do want to mention, too, I think when Badger contacted us in 2002 after the program had ended, so they never rejected the proposal. We didn't have any money to give you.
So I guess the question is, are you giving one award for one-seat arena?
If the program is resurrected, I assume that we would follow the same rules, and then the answer would be, we haven't had a program since 2000, but the answer is, I would assume we would allow single sheet ice arena grants in Greater Minnesota. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Representative Olin, you said you weren't going to take up the next bill?
No, I'll take it. I have no witnesses on the next, so I can bring it up.
Alec Ice Arena, you should name it after Marvin Hansen. Wasn't he from there?
Yes, Marv is from there.
He's still there? Okay. He was in the Senate. I remember him. He was in the Senate.
His son is on the Lancaster School Board, but Mars is not around.
Any further questions? Myself or Anthony
Christensen?
Any of the others from Badger?
Well, thank you all for coming, and I'm sorry. When are you going to get home by? Before midnight?
We're not going
to go. Oh, good.
It's a thing for the half 7 hours.
Is it my fault?
Anybody else? I think that's
Oh, I feel so bad.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Did anybody move that one, by the way?
Well, we're just hearing them, and we're going to put them all together, hopefully, next Thursday.
Okay, on 2605, the Halleck Arena, I'll only make a couple comments. Halleck personnel came down last week, because the Halleck one is on school property. The last one was on city property. So they had to go through the school, the education committees to actually get to you. And they did testify last week. And the differences between the two is they're both slight different variations. Badger has none at all right now. Halleck is refurbishing an old ice arena. In fact, an ice arena, I think some of the pictures were sent to you, and they're not in real good shape. And they also have matching funds that they've earned. I think they're asking for $150,000. They do have a $450,000 project, so they are likewise covering their share.
Okay.
The one interesting note that I will give you, and I think they're probably right, is that 110 years ago, Halleck had the first hockey game that was actually played in the United States.
All right, thank you.
Chairman, do we get to see the documentation for that?
I don't know that they had any, but I've heard that story a few times up there, and I know it's one of the first, because there were several, the Halleck and the Evelists had some of the first hockey teams that existed.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Is there anybody else from out of town on any of the bills? Okay, so then Representative Peterson has a couple of outside witnesses testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is House File 1481, which is a request for bond appropriations for the continuous phase two of the 70-meter ski jump in Bloomington. I'd like to give you some orientation, if I could. As background, I first met Paul Erickson before amateur sports had started, and Paul and I worked on this project at one time. It was called the Holman Pole, and it was going to be the first major 90-meter jump that was going to be in a major metropolitan area. We didn't get it through. We ended up, finally, with a 70-meter jump, which is located here in Bloomington. Now, this is 494, Highway 100. You got the Radisson South hotels here in this intersection. You have the 1,000,002 square feet of the Normandale office park. Through here, you have 2,500 acres of active parkland owned by three little parks called Highland Park, Normandale Lake, and the Bush Lake area. And here, you have the Highland Downhill Ski area, which is probably the most active ski area in the state. If you go over there right now, they're just packed on the slope. This land was originally owned by the Minneapolis Ski Club before 494, before Highway 100. And then when Hennepin Park began to acquire this property for the park, they took ownership of the hill where the park, where the ski jump is. I have with me Mr. Jeff Denny, which is a long-standing jumping name in the state of Minnesota, who will make the presentation.
No, I think they're from Duluth.
They are from Duluth.
Right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. I was serious, and welcome, Mr. Denny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to point out the handout that was given to you. Hopefully you see with a nice picture of a ski jump on the front cover. First of all, just to give you a quick history of ski jumping, it goes back a number of years here in the state of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, ski jumping, really the birthplace of ski jumping, started here in Minnesota. Back in the 1880s in Red Wing, Minnesota, the first national ski jumping competition was held. And in the late 1880s, actually the world record in ski jumping was attained by the Hemisfeth, Norwegian immigrant brothers from Red Wing, Minnesota. And that tradition continued throughout many communities throughout Minnesota. And the Bloomington site was started back in the 1930s. A jump was erected there. We've had numerous competitions, national and local and regional competitions since then. Also, the Bloomington Jump is the largest ski jump in a major metropolitan area, with most of the ski jumps having grown up in very small rural communities. We have the luck of having it in such a very visible site for our facility. As far as the number of people that have participated in ski jumping over the years, we've been really lucky here in Minnesota. It truly is an Olympic sport, and one that we've been able to generate huge number of Olympians for the size sport that it is. Actually, 32 Minnesotans have competed in the Olympic Games as ski jumpers, and half of those 32 members have come from the Twin Cities area, and the rest have come from outstate Minnesota. And that trend has continued throughout the years. As you can see, in the 1970s and through 1980, we had six members of the Olympic team were from Minnesota. Six of the seven members were from Minnesota. A great testament to the heritage here in Minnesota of this sport. And that has waned in recent years. And part of that is because one thing that we don't have in ski jumping that is really required right now is a year-round facility, and at the Bloomington site. And what I mean by that is that we now have a surface that's put on ski jumps that virtually across the world in the major pockets of ski jumping, they're able to ski on a year-round basis and really at a very competitive level. They have actual World Cup competitions in the summertime throughout Europe, and the speed, the technique is all exactly the same as it is in the wintertime. And what we're looking for is to be able to finish phase two, which was the original phase of this jump was built started in 1998 through a grant by the legislature. But phase two is cut from that, which would have been the summer surface, allowing us to use it for 9 months, an additional 9 months of the year, rather than just the 3 months of winter time. One other thing to point out, we've got a facility that does have a summer surface up in the Coleraine area near Grand Rapids, Minnesota. That was put on, again, summer surface. The original construction was done with partly through a grant from the state of Minnesota, and also the summer surface was put on with a grant through a partial grant from the state of Minnesota. And so we're asking to do the same to the southern Minnesota. Obviously, the kids in northern Minnesota benefit greatly from that facility, and the kids in this part of the state must travel great distances for that. And then again, to have it in a major metropolitan area brings great attention to our sport as well. You'll see on the last page in the handout has a picture of the Olympic jumps in Park City, Utah, which has the summer surface on the jump. And it does become a very interesting site to look at, but also becomes very fit with the environment. Usually the summer surface is green, as you can see on yours, the plastic surfaces, and porcelain tracks are very durable and last for decades. The facility also it enhances the ability for the jumps not to have washout issues with the landing surfaces, so that would be another benefit to the environment there on the site. And and by the way, if any of you are open for something to do this weekend, we've got a ski jumping competition on Saturday with the young kids, and then Saturday evening competition and a Sunday afternoon competition. So if you have your skis waxed up and want to bring them out to the jump for a little try, we'd be glad to give you a hand learning the sport.
I'll go right after I'm going to cheers.
And Mr. Chairman, I also have Mr. Jack Rose from the club, who's also been a board member for quite a number of years, who is very involved with the junior jumping and the training of young jumping.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I see Rose, you pronounced it right. It's a famous name in my former country. President Tito's last name was Rose. Rose.
Well, we brought all the armament we could.
Yeah. I remember name like Gene Picard and Adrian Watts.
I skied with all of them. Gene's brother Glenn was my coach growing up in the Duluth area.
Oh, okay. Now, one of them was in an international ski jumping competition in Yugoslavia, and Tito, President Tito, was there. I remember watching it on TV. Anyway.
And I think Mr. Denny has the record. There were three Denny brothers. What's that story?
Yeah. In 1977, two of my brothers and I were on the national team at the time, and we all won the national championships in that same year, which is all three of the age levels, and it was the first time in history that happened in one family, and it was pretty a great honor for myself and my family and for the city of Duluth, too.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you. Does it represent? Con has a question.
Well, first of all, as this is the picture in Park City.
Yes, correct.
Why does it look so awful? I mean, it looks like there's probably wasted. I mean, is there a less environmentally wasted area to do it here? I'm just looking at all this exposed earth and so forth that we're looking at in that.
Sure, Representative Conn, it's a very arid area out in the mountains of Utah, so there's not a lot of pine growth and vegetation that you see in places like Minnesota. If I had pictures of the coal rain jump, you'd see foliage all around it, as you would here in the Bloomington site. It's surrounded by
beautiful. There's one in a summer jump in Coleraine, and then and that's the only one in the state. What about in the general area? Are there any other?
The only other one would be in very northern Illinois, almost the Wisconsin border, rural, kind of very rural area there, too.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, I promised Representative Peterson that we'll fund this if we see him go off the season.
I wasn't sure if you were referring to go down the jump or the jump off the top. I'm not sure what the adjustment is.
I just go down the jump and say,
I talked to Representative Moe. There is a rite of passage in Bloomington in senior year high school that they ascend to the top of the jump. And I asked all three of my daughters, have you done this? Yes. And luckily, I didn't know it for several years. And I find out today that Representative Moe has also made that trip to the top of the jump.
But they don't.
In high school.
They just climb down again?
They climb back down.
Well, maybe you can just do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I guess Representative Hartman is next, and then, I'm sorry, Hartman. And then we have two historical society bills, Morrow's and Mariani's, so maybe they could do it together. Somebody could get the... Okay. Welcome, Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, I'll be very brief because I know you'd like to get out of here, and I'm supposed to be in environment right now presenting a trail bill. But you already know the National Sports Center in Blaine is really our state's flagship amateur sports facility. We have almost 4 million visitors annually. I'm sure Mr. Erickson touched on that before when I was upstairs or downstairs. The facility opened its doors in 1989, and there are many assets that are wearing out at that 18 to 20 year mark. Two that will be talking to you about right now, the roof replacement and parking lot overlays. The members of the Capital Investment Committee this summer or fall came out and rode around in the parking lot on golf carts. I think Representative Erdahl was there, so he knows about the potholes in the parking lot, and it's really in pretty tough shape. But it is a very used facility, and so these investments are well worth making. The National Sports Center Foundation has operated the facility without state operating subsidy since 1989, and they've paid for many of these types of investments over the years, but it's always been the policy of the board that the original capital outlay for new state buildings at the National Sports Center would be the responsibility of the state of Minnesota, and so that's why we're here asking for your support, and Paul has more of the details.
I think you really summarized 90% of it. Again, the National Sports Center has a state-controlled nonprofit. They've operated it without state subsidy, and many of the short-term capital replacement costs they've taken. But now we're at the 18 to 20-year mark, so basically the parking lots have a lot of problems in the roof. And so this rectifies that basic need at the 20-year capital replacement point in time.
Thank you. All right. Have a good weekend. Okay, let's see. I thought I saw Rosette Knuth here. She just left. Okay. 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 Well, maybe we could. Okay, come on.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. Here to speak on House File 2729, the Heritage Trail. I have with me Dave Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society to talk more about the bill.
Welcome, Steve. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is David Hurleher. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Historical Society. First, let me call your attention to the booklet that was passed out earlier. It looks like this. This booklet contains a summary of each of the five requests that the Minnesota Historical Society has in the capital budget this year, and this is one of them. The Heritage Trails request fulfills a need at our historic sites in many cases where there is either not a facility that is staffed or it's a lower level of service, so that we can interpret history where it happened at those sites and give visitors, this is on page 15 of the booklet if you want to follow along in the booklet. A good example is the First Cooley Battlefield, where we do not have staffing, but yet we're able to provide an interpretive program to visitors at that site. This particular request is for two historic sites, the Fort Ridgely Historic Site and the Upper Sioux Agency Historic Site. The Fort Ridgely site had sort of half of a trail completed with funds from the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, where we were able to work on the interpretive signs, but not really quite connect them with an ADA handicapped accessible trail. So this request is to complete the trail, make it accessible and more usable for visitors. The second portion of the request is for a complete trail, including the interpretive markers and the trail construction at the Upper Sioux Agency historic site, which is adjacent to the state park in southwestern Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on this specific request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kelleher. I think this is a good project. Fort Ridgely, Birch Cooley are near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate the efforts to restore there. And that brings me to my question about Birch Cooley. When I was there a couple of years ago, the prairie was becoming overgrown with trees and brush. Have they taken care of that yet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I've not been to that site myself recently, so I'm not entirely certain, but I know that they've done some prairie burns in recent years, and I will make sure that the staff person responsible for that is on the issue if there is further work needed at that site.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Are these 1 through 5 in order of the department's preference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, if you look on page 2, yes, that's the ranking priority order for the Minnesota Historical Society.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
Now we have another Historical Society bill here, David.
Good evening, Mr.
Good evening. Welcome, Representative Mariani and David again.
Mr. Mariani, this is the Minnesota Historical Society and Historic Site Preservation. We've had a long hearing, so I'll be real brief. You guys all know that after preservation is an exception to both citing and planning reports, and it's very important to tell you that. And we have a landscape, we have a terrific inventory of incredible sites, including two of mine, that we gave to the Hill House, and we're walking with here in the Alexander Ramsey House. But obviously, the only one that has the time to do is for the Jeffrey Bishop, Lighthouse, these are all over. They have, I don't need to tell you of the importance, I think, of our efforts in our state to preserve our historical assets and our history. You know, I chair the policy committee, where we very much care about kids and their education and part of their education outside of our capable schools, including on these sites. There are over 200,000 kids a year coming to these sites in a structured way. This is obviously a good investment for the education of our young, and as well as the education for our older adults. as well. Like I said, it's not glamorous work, but it's necessary work. We have to make sure that we find skin not deteriorate, then we've got some real issues with a number of them.
Yeah, I don't have the list here, but I think the governor recommended this one.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the governor recommended this at $5 million out of a $7.5 million. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will point out in the booklet that you have, there are some pictures of the needs at the historic sites on pages 10 and 11, and you can get a sense of some of the real nitty-gritty work that needs to be done at the various sites. And then there's a complete list of the projects that are contained within this request on page 12 of the booklet.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Kelleher, in looking at this bill, let's just pull a site out of the air. Let's say that a new marker was needed in, you know, maybe this place like no action. Is this where the money would come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verdo, I thought you were going to bring up the last bill that was up, but there is some funding in this pool for monuments and markers. If there's a place where, as we heard in the case of the Hinckley Monument, if it's on land that's publicly owned, that would be the location. So yes, it would be a possibility if there were funding for something like that.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you for
don't leave, Dave.
Okay.
Can I leave?
You can leave.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, Representative Stomper, and then...
What do you think?
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I'll do it quick.
Okay, you have... Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, then we can let David go faster. I'm sorry, I forgot about this bill. It's a historical society bill, too. So we might as well kill three birds with one stone. Bill. Kill three birds. Bill. No. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is a bill to appropriate $2 million to the Minnesota Historical Society for county and local jurisdictions. Mainly, this is where your county historical societies get money to give or to use for projects that they have. It's a good bill. It's something that is consistently done through bonding, and your support would be very appreciated.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add is that on page 13 of the booklet, there's a little further description of this program. And I think circulated also is a map that shows the previous grants that have gone out to cities and counties across the state in 14 years. Generally, it's been funding every bonding bill for about that time frame for these grants.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And then now, let's see. We have three bills with Shumper or Snooze? Who's Shumper? That's right. Welcome, Mr. Stumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. My bill is House File Number 3116. It's actually an idea of Representative Hausman's. I've got three really neat historical venues, I guess, or projects in my district. I think you've got some handouts from several of the Hoka City Hall buildings. Anyhow, the idea of this bill is to give an appropriation to the Minnesota Historical Society and for them to make some grants to these three projects. The Hoka City Hall is a WPA building built in 1938, used for a lot of things, a lot of wedding dances and other community activities. In fact, yes, Representative Verdal has been there twice. In fact, my parents had the first wedding dance there in June 1st, 1939. So dear to my heart.
Their first wedding dance, how many weddings?
Oh, their only wedding dance. They had the first dance there. Went to a lot of them there when I was a little kid, you know, before they had babysitters. So, it's a building that needs some renovations, some air conditioning work and heating work and so on. There's been a lot of volunteer work done already. I think you have a handout there and some pictures. We use it extensively during the flood in August for all kinds of community needs as well. It's kind of the local entertainment center. Hoka is only a community of about 550 people, and so, you know, it's really important in that regard. And it's still a pretty good building. They had an engineer come and check it out. It's quite sound. They're thinking they need about $100,000 to complete all the renovations. The second project is the Houston County Historical Society expansion. If you've ever come to Houston County, you've got to make sure you go to the Historical Society, which is kind of spread all over the county. They've got buildings in four different locations, two of the 12 buildings are already on the, the National Register of Historic Places. I don't know why, but everybody who ever grew up in Houston County donates things from their extended families back to the Houston County Historical Society, and so we've got buildings all over that are stuffed with artifacts of things that are in need of being cleaned up and preserved and displayed. And so the Historical Society started about 3 or 4 years ago this fundraising effort to build this fairly large expansion, about 10,000 square feet, and I think you have a handout that shows a picture of it. This is going to be located right next to the Houston County Fairgrounds in Caledonia, which is the county seat. There's like 8 buildings already in this complex, and this is going to be a large building that kind of brings them all together, providing all kinds of rooms, place for instructional displays, genealogy, photo exhibits, and interactive type of displays for tourism and children, as well as a gift store. The long-term plans are to make this a really important tourist destination. You know, we have, within the next 10 or 15 years, we'll have completed all the Red River Trail Network in Houston and Fillmore County, and so all these communities will be connected with this. And so this is kind of a neat, inclusive type of idea. Right now, they've done all this stuff, and it's really remarkable, and I think you were there, weren't you, Representative Peterson and Representative Erdahl there? They've done all this work with volunteers over the years, and they've raised about 600,000 of the approximately 1.2, actually about 700,000 of the 1.2 million they think they need to build this building and equip it. And so the third project then is in Fillmore County. These two projects are in Houston County. The third project is in Fillmore County, and that's the Chatfield Brass Band Music Library, and this is probably the most unique project of anything yet. There was a guy who played in a brass band named Jim Perkins. For many years he played in his brass band, and he had a brass band in Chatfield, and as he got older he started collecting sheet music from all over the country, and he actually, his family actually built and started a, they got a little building there off to the edge of Chatfield. And they literally have collected sheet music from all over the world. And this is actually a lending library. They actually, if you want to get some music for your band, whether it's a marching band or a dance band or whatever, you can contact them and they will either make copies or they will, in some cases, they actually send you the original sheet music. Much of what they have collected are the original copies or productions of this sheet music. The problem is this building is kind of small and they need to have a bigger building to display it and also to preserve it because it's getting quite old now. And the Chatfield School District voted just a year ago or last, yeah, I think it was a year ago, to build a new school building. And they're going to be locating that a little outside of town, to the edge of town. And the present school building is right on Main Street in Chatfield. And so the plans are to build a new building on this lot where the old school will be torn down, just exclusively for this music lending library. So it'll be right on Main Street, right on 52. Again, another attempt to have a tourist destination over the years. This is really going to be a super place because there's a nice big park and band shell across the street, and they currently have like a music festival or something once a year, but they really like to expand that and do it all in conjunction with this new building they want to build for the lending library. So I think the price tag, I think you have a sheet there that gives a breakdown of what the proposal looks like. I think it's around $814,000. So this one is, they're hoping to complete this one in about 18 months. That's what they anticipate. Or not complete, but to start it in 18 months because they're still building the school and they have to move from there. So can I answer any of your questions? Representative Peterson, were you impressed?
I was impressed.
Good.
I'd like to see that museum.
Yeah. Going to be.
Mr. Chairman, again, I guess I've asked this to several ones. Why should this be a separate bill and not just be included in the Historical Society's grants to local historical societies and grants to, and grants for, you know, matching grants to renovations or other places? Since we have that program exists, then, you know, why should this be singled out instead of just be part of that program?
Let's see.
Privately owned?
Pardon? Well, yes. Part of the problem here is that the Historical Society is a separate nonprofit, and the Chatfield Music Library is also a separate nonprofit. City Hall is obviously owned by the City of Hoka. I think the.
Mr. Chairman, isn't that often true about Historical Societies? Their local Historical Societies are often.
Separate.
Well, we have both government and government and nonprofit, local government.
Mm-hmm.
I guess David isn't here. Oh, yes, he is.
Yeah.
Can you explain other restrictions on that program?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn, county historical societies have sort of a patchwork of ownership. Some of them are in buildings that are owned by a 501c3 nonprofit. Some of them are in buildings that are owned by governmental units. We have two basic grant programs that the Minnesota Historical Society operates. The one that I just described is funded with bond funds and obviously can only be used by public entities, cities and counties. Our request for that was $2 million. And that would go a long way to funding a variety of projects. The second grant program that we have is a general fund grant program. That has a small number of dollars and therefore funds very small grants. Last year, we put a one-time appropriation of $500,000 in for the general funded grants program, which helped a lot for kind of the smaller, medium-sized project, because otherwise we're talking about a grant cap of like under $10,000. So I think I'm learning more about the projects that are in this particular bill. I think that the Hoka City Hall has applied for a grant in the bond-funded grant program, but it maybe wasn't enough to finish the project they wanted to do. I'm not sure the amount in the.
As I recall now, I think they were turned down on that application because the money apparently couldn't be used for heating and air conditioning, and that's the big part. I recall reading something like that.
I would need to look into that a little bit.
But that's the lion's share of the cost for the Hoka project was to redo the heating and air conditioning part of it.
In the case of the Houston County Historical Society project, I'm not sure what the amount would be for that, but I think that's, you know, close to the total dollars available. So I think what you have is groups coming forward because there's not enough money in the pipeline to fund the various projects, so they're coming forward with separate bills because there's not enough money.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Stoos, House File 2543. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 2543 is a request for $125,000 for redesign and schematic design for a building that already exists at the Twin Cities Arsenal site in Arden Hills. And it was granted by the federal government to Ramsey County and the Amateur Sports Commission for sports purposes in Arden Hills. And it's pretty ideal terrain for outdoor sports with a lot of hills, a lot of open space. I think all of you would be surprised, but I'm always surprised when I actually get inside it how much open space there is. Last time I was there, I saw a flock of wild turkeys and several deer. And it's a combination of this building that we could renovate as well as the neat terrain with the hills and the open space. That would create an ideal situation for cross-country skiing and mountain biking and type of cross events. And it could also possibly be used for some outdoor education that we would be in our other group. And I'm going to let Mr. Erickson explain some of the details.
Okay, go ahead.
Very briefly, on the handout, the second page, I think tells the whole story. This is 2 miles by 2 miles, the CCAP site. The buildings identified, as President Knuth said, it exists. It just needs to be refitted for student our purposes. In the Met Council did a study about what area in the Twin Cities has the biggest hills in topography, and the banks of the Mississippi near Fort Snelling and this site are the top two. So if you want vertical drop, you want to have a dynamic cross-country ski or mountain bike course that could draw people in from the region, this is the site. And this thing called Ramsey County is the title holder of the land underneath and the building, so we have a joint use agreement pending, and there will be no scales for the state because the National Forest and staff would come and run events on a break-even basis. And right now, to sum it up, we're just looking for planning money, $125K, so that 2 years could be used to plan the buildings used correctly, and we would come back in 2 years.
Yes. Okay. Is there any possibility with these things for commercial sponsorship, particularly if we're not, bike companies and that kind of, are you prohibited from looking at that stuff, or what happens?
Chairman and Representative Todd, the site does not have a very good frontage like to a major highway, so that signage probably income would be somewhat limited. But I don't think there would be a prohibition on our understanding of Ramsey County to have some signage that could produce some sponsorship. But I think it would be limited in this setting for these sports.
Mr. Chairman, I thought these were the new upcoming generation wide sports.
We used to have a policy that planning and schematic drawing used to be have to be general fund money, cash.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a long time ago when you and I came there, it was in the 70s.
I don't think so.
Oh,
I think if a project is bondable, I think that...
That's fine.
You probably remember better than I do, but
I'm
I think
not.
The general philosophy is if a project is bondable, the planning and the drawings are bondable too.
Correct.
David, yeah. Is that your...
Redesign schematic are bondable.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not against it. I'm just thinking out loud. But this was... I'm dating. We come from the 70s.
Yes, right. Long time ago.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more bill, and the author, we can't find the author. He's a member of this committee. But he's still got another committee going on, and I don't know where they're meeting. Maybe they're meeting in room 10. Oh, there he is. Okay. But I'll just welcome back Representative Eakin. Yeah, we had this bill as a... general fund cash bill, and I believe it was vetoed. So you want to do it as a bonding bill.
That
okay.
Is correct.
Welcome, sir. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you
to the committee, and yes, it was
Mr.
approved.
Mr. Chairman, this is a separate bill that was vetoed, not part of the bonding bill that was vetoed.
It was actually okay. Representative signing the omnibus bill that he had carried, and it was line item vetoed by the governor last year. So we're introducing it as a bonding bill this year for $80,000 appropriation. It's for, and we gave testimony on this last year, but it's for a Indian burial site in Becker County. It's on Little Floyd Lake, which is just north of Detroit Lake, and it was a constituent of mine, actually a couple of them, who had purchased this property with the intention of developing it and started doing construction and uncovered the remains of several bodies and reported it like they should have, and ended up getting stuck with property that they couldn't develop and couldn't do anything with. And we're not talking about wealthy people. These are people who put a significant amount of their own money invested in this, into this property, and they're just looking for some compensation. The state is looking to purchase it and to preserve this sacred site. I think that it's an important piece of legislation because, you know, these people, if they just ignored the remains and destroyed them and continued to develop, they would have been able to make money on it. But instead, they did the right thing. They reported it, and I think that they should be rewarded for doing the right thing and at least not punished for it. They're not asking to make money off of this. They're just asking that they recoup some of the money that they had lost in this investment. So. And it's a very old find. The burial site is it's at least 4,600 years old. So, and they're asking for $80,000.
What did the governor say in his veto message, or did he say it?
He said something about setting a precedent of purchasing property by the state that would have to be maintained by the state that he didn't think was a good precedent to set. But I think that we've had instances of that happening in the past. Yes. This is not a precedent-setting piece of legislation.
Is another option, is another option of this, I don't quite yet, is another option of this to override the line item veto? Can you override the line item veto?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not sure if you can do a line item.
I think
you have
to be full
bill.
Well,
I'm just
trying
to figure out how to override the line item veto.
Well,
I thought we did that in the current
interest,
but I'm not sure if it was a full bill.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a GOP staff person here. I'm sorry, would you identify yourself and welcome to the committee?
My name is Andrew Heath, and I've been here for about 2 years. I've been in the sergeant's office on the first page, and then in the sergeant's office, and then the PS writer for health care.
Welcome. Thank you. Let's see. And what else do we have? Well, we have to approve the last meeting minutes of May 9, 2007. I'm sure you remember all of
everything.
Okay. Any discussion?
They were very good.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. We'll be meeting once more on the bonding bills, and we don't have as many. At 8 o'clock, I believe, Thursday morning, in this room, in this hearing room, and hopefully we'll be done quicker. Actually, we did a good job today. We had
8 o'clock Thursday morning.
Yeah,
here
in this room.
You want to get any prizes for cooking?
Okay. I'll give you a Turkish coffee. and then we will have to send send the bill to the bonding committee or the capital investment committee by the 22nd, by Friday. And they're all going to be heard on the 26th next week. I believe that's on Tuesday.
Here are the minutes. They're moved and we approved.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.